Howdy there, friends, and thanks for joining us here again on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale. As always, with me today is Mr. Kyle Filson. Kyle, my brother, how are you doing today, sir?
I am doing amazing. I'm excited to be here. We're going to be doing a little history today. One of my favorite subjects is history. And I'm doing great, man. I can't complain. How about you?
Did you keep your powder dry with all the storms? For everybody that's been messaging us and all that and been seen on the news, thank you so much for caring about us. It has been bad. I got a tree down at my house. I've been cutting and working on that. The rains, it got so damp, it actually fell. And it fell through part of my fence, hit part of the house. House isn't damaged. Fence isn't too bad. Fixed that already. It's been wild as hell down here with the rains. It's been pretty crazy. Flash flooding, there's been some deaths, there's been some accidents, there's been some dumbasses think they can drive their vehicles across low water crossings and they get washed down the river, which that's what you get. That's called paying the stupid tax.
Don't drown, turn around.
Exactly. Yeah, just because it's not deep doesn't mean it's not roaring across that area.
That's
so
right.
You got to think about that. But other than that, everything's been good. This week, the weather is going to break. It's going to be beautiful, the whole thing. But without any further ado, I'm going to talk about real quick and give you a quick bio on who we're speaking to today, folks. We're going to jump into it.
No news today.
No news. We're jumping into it with Mr. Graham Phillips. That's right. Graham is actually, for several years now, been one of Britain's best-selling nonfiction authors. And he started writing in the early 80s. He was a radio journalist, a broadcaster for the BBC. He even helped edit some popular magazines over there. But he's turned all of his attention and all of his investigating skills onto these historical mysteries, if you will. Now, he wrote several books. He started doing some writing, co-authoring some books with a fellow named Martin Keatman. But he's been digging into these books and these stories. And, folks, I'll give you a rundown. He talks about Alexander the Great. He talks about the Templars and the Ark of the Covenant. He talks about Merlin and a possible discovery over here in the New World. But the book we're going to be discussing today is The Lost Tomb of King Arthur. And I'll tell you right now, it's a book that I've loved. Kyle loved it. We dove into it. We get into it really good with Graham. Graham covers all the bases on it. You're going to be surprised. If you had your mind set on what you thought King Arthur and the whole story was, and the whole thing was just a bunch of malarkey and maybe a little folktale, we're probably going to change your mind. There's some really interesting stuff that he's found. And, man, I tell you what, I think it's pretty much sealed for me. But before we jump into that, I'm going to hand it over to my brud over here, and he's going to lay out what everybody, bring them up to speed on the whole story of King Arthur. So Kyle, if you will, sir, let's kick this puppy off.
Long ago, when Britain was divided and without a king, barbarian hordes laid waste to the once fertile countryside. The throne lay vacant for a just and righteous man who could free the people from their servile yoke and drive the invaders from the land. But only he who could draw from a stone the magical sword Excalibur could prove himself the rightful heir. Years passed, and many tried, but the magnificent sword stood firm and unyielding in the ancient weathered rock. Then, one day, a youth emerged from the forest, and to the amazement of all, succeeded where even the strongest had failed. The people rejoiced. The king had come, and his name was Arthur. On ascension to the highest office in the land, King Arthur set about restoring the shattered country. After building the impregnable fortress of Camelot, and founding an order of valiant warriors, the Knights of the Round Table, the king rode forth to sweep aside the evil that had beset the kingdom. The liberated peasants took him into their hearts, and Arthur reigned justly over his newly prosperous realm, taking for his queen the beautiful Lady Guinevere. Even a terrible plague, which ravaged the country, was overcome by the newfound resolve of Arthur's subjects, for they mounted a quest to discover the Holy Grail, a fabulous chalice that held the miracle cure for all ills. But as happens so often during an age of plenty, There are those whom power corrupts. Eventually, a rebellion tore the kingdom apart, and an armed uprising led by Modred, Arthur's treacherous nephew. Yet there was a dark witch that lay at the heart of the strife, the scheming enchantress, Morgan. During a final battle, Modred was at last defeated, and Morgan destroyed by Merlin, Arthur's trusted advisor and court magician. But all did not end well, for Arthur himself was mortally wounded. As he lay dying on the field of battle, the last request by the once mighty Arthur was that Excalibur, the source of all of his power, be cast into the sacred lake and lost forever to mortal men. When the magical sword fell to the water, an arm rose from the surface, catching the weapon by the hilt and taking it down into the crystal depths. When the great king was close to death, he was taken away on a boat, bound for the mystical island of Avalon, accompanied by a group of mysterious maidens. Many say that he died and was buried upon that island. There are those who believe that Arthur's soul is not to be found among the dead. It is said he only sleeps and one day will return. This, in essence, is the fabulous tale of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Most people know it in one form or another, all over the world. But today, we have a special guest with us, a Mr. Graham Phillips. And he says that King Arthur was not just a fantastical story, but in fact a real man. Not only that, he knows the final resting place of King Arthur. He knows the final resting place of the magical sword, Excalibur. He knows where Camelot was. And he also believes he knows who the real Merlin was. So without further ado, Mr. Graham Phillips, let's begin.
Well, with us today, we have an exceptional author, Mr. Graham Phillips, and he's talking with us today about his new book, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, The Search for Camelot and the Isle of Avalon. Graham, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you indeed.
I'm
all the way from England.
All the way from England.
You can tell by my accent, I'm not a good old boy.
What town in England are you in?
It's Birmingham. It's pretty much smack being in the middle of the country. It's the second biggest city in England after London.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I have to tell you, this new book that you wrote is amazing. I never thought that King Arthur might have been a real person. Now, everybody knows the legend of King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table, Camelot, the famous sword Excalibur, and even the wizard Merlin. But everybody thinks this tale is only a myth. But could the story actually have been inspired by an actual historical figure, a real King Arthur, who happened to be an important chieftain of the 5th or 6th century, fighting and defending the people, the ancient people of Britain during the Dark Ages? In the 5th century, King Arthur, his area of Britannia was an anarchy. And when the Romans left, the tribes of the Angles and the Saxons from Denmark and Germany were on the attack. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The story that we know today about Arthur and his shining armor and his rescuing damsels in distress and fighting dragons and so forth, that was like fictional works written from around about 1150 onwards. But before then, many hundreds of years before, there are various references during the so-called Dark Ages. That's the period from when the Roman Empire collapsed in the 400s. And the Roman legions left Britain until the period of around about 1000 AD. There's a kind of 500-year period called the Dark Ages when the country just collapsed into chaos after the Romans left, and there was the broken kingdom of Britain broke into separate kingdoms, or wars warring each other. And as you said, the Anglo-Saxons, as they're known, came from Germany and started to invade. During this period, a number of references, records, for example, by a monk called Nennius, who wrote around the year 830, who talks about King Arthur in a purely historical setting. They say that there was a real King Arthur, that he existed around about the year 500. He united the Britons to fight the Anglo-Saxons. And references like that are not, they don't have him fighting dragons, they don't have him, you know, doing anything magical or mystical. They simply say that he was a warrior who united the British people and won a series of successful battles. So that is why I believe that there was actually an historical figure upon whom these later legends and stories were based.
Well, and it also, I want people to know that this wasn't just like an easy thing. Like we think today, you know, oh, well, I'll just get on online or I can go down to the local library and pull it all up. I'm sure during these dark ages, there wasn't a lot of record keeping. Like, I know the Romans kept a lot of records, but I'm sure in between that time and let's say the time of the medieval Middle Ages era, the record keeping must have been shoddy at best. So the idea of you finding it is amazing to me also, the work you had to put in for that.
The reason there's so little records that survive from the Dark Ages is really, well, threefold. One, everyone was so busy fighting everybody else that there was never much time to sit down and write, except for monks in monasteries. Secondly, one thing that people forget is that in order to write and have it preserved, you've got to have something to write on and to write with. Now, the manufacture of writing materials and inks and the manufacture of paper was fine when you've got some kind of, you know, industries that was here during the Roman period. But once that went, apart from, again, a few isolated monasteries, no one was producing anything to write on or to write with. So apart from inscriptions on stone, gravestones and so forth, we really don't know that much about it. The third reason why there is very few writings surviving from that period is because the damp, horrible weather conditions of Britain mean that anything that was written, unless it was kept really safely in, again, perhaps a monastery or an abbey, it would have just rotted away. And there is, in fact, only literally a handful of records that do survive from this period. But the interesting thing is that nearly all of them do make a reference to King Arthur as being an historical figure.
I guess I've got to ask you this because it drives. How much was your blood pumping when you kind of started down this, and then all of a sudden you started finding these breadcrumbs that were leading, that you started piecing together? You had to get your blood pressure up when you started finding this, because we're teasing this, fixing to get into it. So the listeners, we can't just jump in just yet, because it's an amazing story of actually kind of how you traced it all down, because I kind of alluded to fight names. You think of men that are boxers or MMA fighters, they all have these fight names. And it's almost like how you found this fellow was through fight names.
Yeah, people have said that the earliest references from the Dark Ages, which date from the period of which Arthur existed, they, although I said a lot of the Dark Age references mention him, the period that he actually lived, the contemporary references, don't mention him. And people have said, historians have said, well, this proves that these later writers, even though it was still during the Dark Ages and centuries before the medieval romantic stories are written, that this King Arthur must have been invented later on because there's no contemporary references to him. But then I began to realize that many of the people, the historical figures that existed around the period just after the Romans left, the Celtic people of Britain, as they were known, and Celtic people still survive in Wales in Britain or Ireland, but all of England was occupied by Celtic people at this time, and they had a tradition of, if a warrior proved himself magnificent in battle, he was given a battle name or a title, usually of an animal, or a mythical animal or a real animal, like the fox, for example, for somebody who was cunning. If somebody was far-sighted, they might be called the eagle, and so on. And I realized that a lot of figures that we have, you know, that people have studied history of that period, a lot of these figures that they know about under their battle names or these titles. So I began to wonder whether Arthur might have been preserved under a similar battle name or title, which is why his name isn't in contemporary records. And there was a writings of a monk by the name of Gildas, who wrote within living memory of the period Arthur is said to have lived. So he's a contemporary author, and he writes about various leaders of Britain, and he talks about one of them under the name, he's writing in Latin, he writes about him under the name Ursus, which is Latin for the bear. So there's this character called the bear, but we don't actually, in that particular writings that Gildas refers to, that is making, tells us who he is. He just talked to him about him by his title, like he does many other contemporary figures. Interestingly, and this is when the blood really started pumping, when I thought, I wonder what the name Bear would have been in Brythonic. That was the language spoken in Britain at the time. And sure enough, when I looked that up, the name for a bear is Arth, A-R-T-H. And I began to think that is so similar to Arthur. I could see how it could have developed into Arthur as years went past, especially if perhaps you coupled the names, like often happened, the Brythonic British name plus the Latin name, and you'd get Arth Ursus, shortened to Arthur, like Antonius is shortened to Antony and so forth. And it was at this point I thought, wow, I think that this guy, and Gildas refers to him as the most powerful warlord in Britain around the year 500. I thought, this has got to be Arthur. So you were asking about blood pumping. That's when it started to pump.
I can only imagine. I mean, I started getting all geeked up just reading the book. I started getting excited because of the whole thing, because it starts, we always talk about on the show, we love the little lines, the little threads that lead to more things that you can actually weave together to tell the story, because it starts adding up where you're like, there's really no other way for it to go. This is seems to be what it was. And over these years, because I was like everyone else, and Kyle discussed and we discussed, I was under the impression, I even told you off air, you know, that it was the Sean Connery idea. As I think of it, with all the beautiful shiny armor and the giant horses and the maiden's fair and all this, and that's really not any of this time that it was way prior to that. And then you start finding out, you're like, oh, okay, now it starts adding up. We start looking, we may have been looking in the wrong spot at the wrong time this entire time. And there's something else that you touched on that I enjoyed. And I think that's probably where we should really get rolling with it is I believe, I hope I pronounce it right, Viriconium?
That is correct, Viriconium.
That, just the idea of there being an ancient city that was there this whole time, and that's where this whole thing started. And I mean like an ancient city, I'm thinking of much like what we have at Cahokia here in the United States, is it's like giant earthenworks and big wooden walls. And if anyone's seen the movie Braveheart, you kind of have the idea of the stockade walls up around everything in the wood. That's kind of what I pictured this place to look like, of where the story starts.
That's pretty much it. In the Middle Ages, these stories are written about Arthur, and they all say that he ruled from this magnificent city, the capital of Britain, when he lived. Now, the thing is that what happened during the Middle Ages is that authors started to write stories about ancient times and set them in their own historical period. And that was a period of knights in shining plate armor with lances and broadswords and castles, like Gothic castles, like we are familiar with from the Robin Hood stories and so on. Mm-hmm. But they didn't exist until, you know, the 12th, 1300s at that period of time. Going back to the period that Arthur is said to have lived, it wasn't long after the Romans left, British warriors would have dressed in, for the best way to explain it, is Roman-style armor. They fought with Roman-style, much shorter swords. They hadn't even invented stirrups at this point, so riding on horses, you couldn't possibly have held a lance and gone charging at somebody because you'd have fallen off your horse. Mm. You needed pretty much at least one hand on your reins of the horse, and you couldn't hold one of those great big lances without basically having both hands free. So there's a lot of, and also you were talking about the kind of stockades. Castles of the sort of Gothic sort didn't exist until the Middle Ages. Back at that period, you've got Roman-style fortifications. Houses were pretty sophisticated, and so were places people lived in. They had underfloor heating, which the Romans invented, which you need in Britain because it's so cold and rainy. But the kind of fortifications would have been wooden stockades built on top of earth and embankments and surrounded by ditches. That's the kind of way that this is the sort of capital city that there would have been at this historical period Arthur lived. So what I wanted to do is to try and find out, as this man, Ursus the Bear, Arthur, really existed, where would he have ruled from? Because Gildas doesn't actually tell us that. The monk doesn't tell us exactly where he came from. So I'm trying to look for an historical Camelot, if you like. Somebody would say, well, why don't you just look at a map and find a place called Camelot? Well, there is nowhere called that in Britain anymore. And also, it seems that the name Camelot was invented in the 1190s by a French poet called Chrétien de Troyes. he wanted a word to rhyme with Lancelot, so he came up with Camelot. Before that, there are other stories written about Arthur's magnificent city, but it's not given a name. It seems that by the Middle Ages, people had forgotten what it was called. So I wanted to find out what was the most important city around 500 AD, when Arthur is said to have lived. Now, the Angles and Saxons had invaded the east of Britain, which included the capital of Roman Britain and post-Roman Britain, London, which left the biggest city that was left unoccupied by the Anglo-Saxons around 500 AD was smack bang in the middle of England at a place called, smack bang in the middle of Britain. England is only part of Britain. So smack bang in the middle of Britain, there is a city that was called Viriconium, which was the fourth largest city in Roman Britain, but was the largest free city left at the time Arthur lived. Now, unlike London, whose Roman ruins lie beneath streets and office blocks and houses and buildings, Viriconium, once it was eventually abandoned at the later Dark Ages, was never continued as a prosperous city. So its foundation stones and some of its walls still remain in open countryside in the middle of England, right near a town called Shrewsbury. And in fact, it's open to the public now. A lot of excavations have gone on there, and there's a small museum on the site which has displayed the various finds that have been discovered there. Now, this city, we know because of the archaeological excavations, not only continued to be occupied when the Romans left, when many other cities in Britain were being abandoned for more easily defensible hilltop fortifications, this particular city was completely rebuilt and refortified at exactly the time Arthur is said to have lived. And right in the middle of this city, a massive palatial, Roman-style palatial building was constructed, which was thought to be, this is what archaeologists have said, not me, the seat of a very important post-Roman warlord or chieftain. So everything was tying up. Basically, I'd got a place that seemed to tally with the story of Camelot, i.e. the most important city in Britain at the time Arthur is said to have lived. I'd got a man called Arth, possibly the original name of Arthur, and all I had to do was find out if Arth had ruled from Viriconium. And in the British Library, I discovered, well, other people had read it, but they'd never put the whole thing together, a series of genealogies or family trees written during the Dark Ages, which said what kings ruled where and when. And the king who ruled from Viriconium at the time that Arthur is said to have lived, his real name was Owen Thangwin. And he is recorded as being known as the Bear. So the Arthur I discovered tied up with the archaeological evidence suggesting what the most powerful city in the country was.
And the most powerful man ruling it was Owen. Now when we tell people and when they hear Thangwin, it's not written that way. It's actually written with double D's, but it's pronounced with the TH, correct?
That's right, because the Brythonic, which developed into modern day Welsh, hadn't got a T. We used T and H for th. They used a double D.
It was the pre-Anglo invasion, basically, before that kind of got rolled into their language and all that, where it kind of crossed over, right?
The first Anglo-Saxon started using a variation of the letter Y, but with a kind of tail on it to represent th sound, which is where we mistakenly believe that people spoke ye olde English. It was always the old English.
Well, and I think that that's an important thing to mention, too, because when we start talking about Merlin and Gwendolyn, you start talking about these things, is because a lot of this stuff can be lost in translation, in the way of the writings. A lot of these names can be kind of twisted a little bit to where they're easily changed from maybe a Charles to a Chuck, something, you know, real slight, but could be lost in history real fast. And that's why it's important to do what you did.
And also you're changing from one, from English to Latin to French to whatever language. I mean, Britain, was invaded firstly by the Romans, so we ended up with Latin got involved in the language. Then came the Anglo-Saxons, so we ended up with pretty much what is German, early German, tied up with the language. Then came the Vikings, so we ended up with Danish and Norwegian. And then came the French, they invaded us, and so we ended up with French being added in. So the modern English is a combination of a whole lot of different languages.
Well, and I guess everybody's, because I was all excited, but because everybody's favorite is always Merlin. But you found someone that you've tied to Merlin also.
Yeah, what was really interesting is that I wanted to find out if any other characters involved in the Arthur story may have been based on historical figures. And Merlin is probably the most fascinating because he is supposed to be in the, you know, in all the medieval tales. He's the kind of real power behind the throne. It's him who prepares the way for Arthur and advises him and so on. Okay, so I might not actually believe that he could do all these magic things, but was there a real person who maybe had knowledge that others didn't have of healing or military tactics or whatever it would needed to make King Arthur so successful? The monk Nennius that I mentioned, who wrote in 830, refers to a series of Arthur's battles, also refers to a man called Ambrosius, who seems to have been risen to power to rule the Britons at the time that Arthur is said to have, just before the time Arthur is said to have done that. Now, in the earliest Arthurian tales in the Middle Ages, Merlin's real name is Ambrosius. He's another character that has one of these battle names, if you like, or a name that these names of animals were not only given to warriors, they were given to other people of renown, holy men and so on. And Merlin, the name Merlin actually means eagle in Brythonic. There's actually still a small bird of prey called a Merlin today. And his real name, we're told, was Ambrosius. Now, if this seems to be the same Ambrosius that Nennius is talking about, who was actually a ruler before the time Arthur ruled. And if we go back to some earlier references, like this MacGildas I mentioned, who wrote within living memory of Arthur's time, he talks about Ambrosius being ruling Britain in the late 400s. He's the last of the Roman generals in Britain. Apparently, when most of the Roman Empire in the West collapsed to the advancing Gothic armies of the Germanic-speaking Goths, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, and so on, the last of the legions fled over the British, over the English Channel from France, settled in England, and like the last of the Roman soldiers under the command of this man, Ambrosius Aurelius, helped to fend off the Anglo-Saxon invasions. This man, Ambrosius Aurelius, I believe from the evidence, was the historical Merlin. Now, for some reason, he had to retire from office before he died. Perhaps he was wounded, perhaps he got too old. And it was Arthur who took over shortly after his period. So it's very possible that this Ambrosius Aurelius was the man, the last of the Roman generals. Gildas calls him the last of the Romans. He even says he descended from a Roman emperor. And there's an Aurelius emperor, Marcus Aurelius, who's the good emperor at the beginning of the film Gladiator.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this man is supposed to be a descendant of his. So it seems that the real historical Merlin was a Roman who knew Roman tactics, who knew about various forms of medicine and so forth at the period of the Dark Ages when this was quickly being forgotten. And therefore he, being wounded or too old, advised Arthur and became, in legend, the figure of Merlin the magician.
Well, that makes perfect sense. You laying it out like that, it makes, because I was thinking about, like, the Hand of the King. He's the man. He's the advisor to, and it makes sense because Arthur may not have been raised the way the Romans were, but he taught, it pretty much explains his actions as a Roman, is because he's being advised by a true old school Roman, as is advising him on this is how you run your country. This is how we ran it, and this is how you should run yours as well.
Yeah, this guy, Owen Van Gwyn, who seems to have been the historical Arthur, actually came from Britain. He was a native Briton. He seems to have spent some time in London before the Anglo-Saxons started to invade, but he was a native Briton. So he would have needed the advice of somebody from the Roman Empire on military tactics in order to beat the Anglo-Saxons.
it starts making perfect sense as you lay it all out. Now, you were talking about the French rider. Now, the French rider that you're speaking of is the one that tried to add Camelot. He tried to add it because he's actually the man that added Lancelot, correct?
Lancelot was already a figure in the romantic writings in France in the 1100s, completely separate as a hero to Arthur.
So they were
and
no
it
connection.
Seems that what happened is that this Chrétien de Troyes, a French writer, wanted to add a French hero into the story of King Arthur, which was coming ever more popular. So there was many figures that were kind of added on that had nothing to do with the original King Arthur, and Lancelot seems to be one of them.
So now that we've talked about Arthur and Merlin, of course we have to move to the famous sword, Excalibur. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is, I mean, when I was looking for historical figures, I didn't really expect originally Merlin to be a real one. He seemed to be the less likely to be a real one. I thought Lancelot was more likely to be real. I mean, he's just a warrior. Merlin does magic tricks. So, but that was a surprise. Even more of a surprise was the fact that the one of the themes from the Arthurian story that I thought has got to be made up was the Excalibur story. Because according to the legend, when Arthur is dying on the field of battle, he eventually has this rebellion, which is led by Mordred, his nephew, and the two of them kind of give each other a fatal blow on the field of battle. Mordred dies immediately. Arthur kind of like, you know, takes his time dying and tells his one of his knights to throw his sword, Excalibur, into a nearby lake. And when the knight does this, this arm of this mysterious nymph-like figure called the Lady of the Lake breaks the surface, comes up, grabs the hilt of the weapon and takes it down into the depths of the lake. And when the knight then returns to Arthur, he finds that Arthur has died, or at least he's being carried away on a barge across the lake that he's just thrown Excalibur in, to an island in the middle called Avalon, where he dies, or he's buried, according to some legends. Now, the whole thought story of a Lady of the Lake, a kind of mermaid type thing, getting Excalibur, seemed a bit crazy. But I found that Roman writers, when referring to Celtic practices in Britain, said that when a warrior died, as part of his funeral rite, his sword was thrown into a sacred lake as an offering to a water goddess in order to provide him with safe passage to the underworld. Now, could this story of a water goddess, and they believe that if you threw the sword into this sacred lake, be associated with the Excalibur story? You know, it gradually became an idea that there's a real lady swimming around in there. One thing I realized immediately when I heard the name of this goddess that the Celts threw these swords to was that her name, Viviana, was so similar to the name Vivian, which was the name of the Lady of the Lake in the earliest tales. So I believe that this is why the story of Excalibur came from. And it's not just that the Romans have told us about these swords being thrown into lakes. Archaeologists have excavated the beds of a number of dried up lakes that were sacred to the Celts and found, amongst other items, that swords were thrown into them and they were preserved in the mud at the bottom of the lake that then dried out. So that is how I believe the Excalibur story came about. So yeah, it's basically telling us that these stories that were written in the Middle Ages were really based on something that had happened. And of course, it gradually got, you know, more exaggerated as time went by.
Well, and I know, looking into some of the stuff in the past that we've done, is like you brought up the Germanic and the different things. That's also where we get our wishing wells. This isn't something new. This is where, because I was always laughing about looking at stuff that we did. I've always thought it was funny little things, quirks that we have over here. And I remember looking into it a while back, and it was a fact that it come from Europeans also, but casting things into water. I think there's even some Nordic myths of like Odin casting like his eye or something into the water, but there's a lot of stuff that goes along with it. So this is an old school belief system. So as warriors, they would be brought up with this pretty much ingrained in them like a religion.
Yeah, the idea was that the Celtic people, particularly of Britain and parts of Europe, believed very much in water goddesses, mm-hmm. that inhabited sacred pools, sacred lakes, sacred wells, and they believed that these lakes or pools or stretches of water were kind of some kind of portal to the other world, the underworld, the next world, heaven, if you like. And by throwing offerings, not just swords at the time of a funeral, but other offerings, money or jewelry, into these lakes and pools and wells, they were getting themselves good luck or making sure that the harvest worked out right and so on. And many, many of these items have been the reason why in Britain, for example, in the museums, we have so much Celtic and Anglo-Saxon jewellery is because a lot of it has been recovered from these dried up lakes and pools where people just threw it away, if you like.
Wow.
But they were throwing it, believing they were throwing it to water goddesses. When the country later became Christian, it was no longer considered right that they should be giving these offerings to water goddesses. So what happened is that water goddesses became transferred into saints, female saints like St. Mary, St. Catherine, St. Anne, and so on. And St. Anne basically was a figure mainly associated with wells, which was St. Anne in the Bible is the in Christian tradition is the mother of the Virgin Mary. But it sounds like Viviana, Anna, as she's called in some areas. So they thought, right, we'll say it's St. Anne instead. And we'll throw offerings to her. But the tradition then became, rather than throwing jewellery and precious items, they threw money. And the late Romans in Britain did this. They became Christians. They started throwing money into wells like the Celts had before them, thrown offerings. And this continues today in the tradition, as you said, of wishing wells.
Wishing wells, yeah. How wild is... Well, just the... first of all, too, we're not going to jump into that part just yet, but the listeners are going to have to look into this because you've did some scanning of some areas and come up with some really interesting stuff. That's one of those things that... There's going to be teasers, folks. You got to get the book because there is some things been found, let's say. We'll just leave it at that as it goes to that deal.
Well, I can tell a bit about it. Get that sort of curiosity going even further.
All right. Take them down the path, then, Graham. Lead them in.
Right. Okay. So remember I said that in the Legend of Arthur, the sword is thrown into this lake, and then he sailed across this lake to an island in the middle called Avalon, where he's supposedly buried. What I wanted to do was to find out where the real historical King Arthur was buried. I mean, the book is called The Lost Tomb of King Arthur. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was when I started investigating the Arthur story, I mean, many, many years ago, I wasn't actually looking for his tomb. I was trying to identify an historical King Arthur. By the time I got to the end of the research and put it all together, I ended up finding what I believe was his tomb. So consequently, that's what they decided to call the book. So what happened? I decided, okay, now I've got to find out where this man, Arthur, Owen Thangwyn, was actually buried. Now having identified a figure who may have been Arthur, i.e. this guy Owen, and knowing that he ruled from Viriconium, it didn't take too long to find out where the kings who ruled from Viriconium were buried. The answer is actually preserved in a Dark Age war poem about the exploits of the kings of Britain that was written in the 600s. And still survives in the Bodleian Library at Oxford University. Now, this particular story tells us that the kings from Viriconium were buried at a place called the Churches of Bassa. Now, when I looked at a map in the area around Viriconium, I found that only about 8 miles to the north of it was a place today called Bass Church. Churches of Bassa, Bass Church, it's surely got to be the same place. And right there, there's a village called Bass Church. And right on the edge of it, there is what is a hill, a small hill, which was is from a limited amount of archaeology that had been done there, is known to have been occupied around 500 AD. And structures, earthworks were built there, like earthen embankments and moats. But it's not believed to have been a defensive structure, because the moat is on the inside of the embankment, which would be silly for a defensive structure. It's more likely to be some sort of ceremonial site. But back in the Dark Ages, the whole of this hill was surrounded by water. It was an island in the middle of the lake, a lake. And a lot of this area has dried up now because the land has been drained for reclaiming farmland, but still some of the parts of the original lake survive. So it's not an island and a lake anymore, but it was during the Dark Ages. This was the place, according to this poem, that the kings from Viriconium were buried. And then I've got another link with Arthur. Arthur is supposed to have been buried on an island in the middle of a lake. Avalon, I thought, could this have been the historical Avalon? Because there's no place in Britain called Avalon anymore, so we don't know where it was. Some people have got ideas that it could be here or there, but here we've got an actual place where kings were buried, from the place where Arthur came from, according to my research, that was an island in a lake. And I thought, we have got to excavate this area. Well, firstly, it's on private land. Secondly, it is protected by an English Act of Parliament. There are certain old buildings or old sites that there's Acts of Parliament in Britain to protect them. They're protected monuments. And so you have to get permission off somebody called, an organisation called English Heritage, to dig. Well, you have to have a very good reason to do that. We couldn't just go digging in this area. But I managed to organise a geophysics survey. Now, what that is archaeologists use different types of equipment, such as ground-penetrating radar, to see what lies under the ground without digging. And in the location that I won't give the whole story away, believe that Owen was buried, I said, I think there's this like acre of land just next to this hill, which would have been part of the island in the middle of this lake. And I believe he should be buried there. So they're headed by an archaeologist, the head archaeologist of that county area, plus a number of other geophysics scientists. They scan the whole area of this equipment over a period of a day. And what they found was right in the middle of this roughly acre of land, there was the signs that a ditch had been dug about 6 feet deep, a circular ditch about 6 feet wide. Now, that is how important high-status individuals were buried at the time Arthur is said to have lived. But what was most incredible is that they said that right in the middle of this ditch, there was a metal object that seemed to be the central boss of a shield. And we know that from other sites that warriors that were buried during the time Arthur is said to live were buried on their sides with a shield on their arm. So right at the point where I believe that the man who was Arthur was buried, they found a burial that's exactly consistent with a high status warrior at the time Arthur is said to have lived.
That is incredible. I cannot believe, you know, that you were able to do this. It's amazing to me. And why do you, Graham, why do you think so many historians and other scholars continue to doubt that King Arthur was ever a historical figure? Why is that?
Well, they probably haven't read my book yet, but even if they do, a lot of them have a go at me saying, oh, you can't say this, you can't say that, you can't say that. The main reason why most archaeologists, historians tend to steer clear of it altogether, because Arthur's been so associated with dragons and damsels in distress and magic and all this sort of thing, to associate your name with him tends to make you seem a bit silly. So most archaeologists, historians take well clear of it. It's too controversial. I'm hoping that now my book is out, that over the next year, and it'll take time, it's not going to happen straight away, but over the next few years, I believe that Arthur will permeate more into the consciousness of people who think, well, yeah, it could be a real figure. And I'm really hoping that an archaeological dig will take place at this site, because at the moment we've got to persuade this organization, English Heritage, that a dig should take place. And I've got archaeologists on side. They want to do it. They want to do the dig properly. This is not just me going over there with a spade. This is proper archaeological excavation. But the wheels of English heritage grind very slowly, and they have a lot of paperwork to get through. So I'm hoping that sometime, maybe this year, maybe next, there could be a dig.
I certainly hope there is. That's one of those things that the red tape battle. You do all this work, and then it seems like the red tape battle is where they always. And I understand it's a sacred site. You know, we all understand that. So we don't want to encourage anybody listening. Nobody go over there with a shovel and a pick. Nobody get over there and start getting carried away. Let's not get wild like that. But if there needs to be a way to like support it. There needs to be like a somebody listening or anybody to build a site, a website where people can sign up and support and want it and try to pressure maybe some of the government into, okay, there's enough clamor for this for them to go look.
That's a good idea. I'm thinking of starting that a bit later there. I'm not doing it now. The only reason I'm not really pushing for it at the moment is because archaeological digging seasons, they have to organize these things a year, maybe in advance. And, you know, many months in advance. And the next digging season, it wouldn't be out any good at digging in the winter. The ground will all be too hard and frozen and cold and wet. So the next digging season will be sort of next spring. So later in the year, in the, you know, late summer or fall, I'm going to start to, I am going to put up a website or part of my own website, sort of trying to get the support to allow this to happen.
We'll try to get as many people as we can to get support, because I want them also to pull up the sword. I want them to find that.
Well, the thing is that this dried up lake, part of the lake is dried up around this central area where this island was, what I believe Arthur was buried. It's there that we can have a scan of that area and possibly find in the dried up mud or even in the bottom of one of the lakes that still survives that there is a sword. And how would we know if it was Excalibur? Well, I mean, if there's a lot of swords buried there, which there could be because no one's done a complete archaeological geophysics scan of what was the dried up lake. If there is a sword there, well, the way I'd know it was Excalibur is because I've got a very old description of Excalibur made in the Dark Ages, which tells us that the earliest reference to it says that it had a golden hilt with two serpents entwined around it. Gold is not going to rot away at the bottom of water, so it could survive. And if it's got two serpents around it, I think that's the nearest we're going to get to proof that we found an historical Excalibur.
That would be an amazing find to pull that up out of the old. I'm picturing the bottom just like nasty old mud. It's probably silted in over all of these years. No telling what it's buried in, but I can imagine dragging it up out of there. I picture one of those underwater like machines where they try to pull up gold like a vacuum. You need to vacuum all that stuff up and pump it out someplace else where you can get down there to it.
Right. That is incredible. Also, like Graham, how in your book you're talking about, if anybody thinks that all these findings and stuff that you've discovered is all hogwash, you even point out in your book that although there's a lack of historical documentation or an inscription from that time period bearing King Arthur's name, that there's other historical figures who existence, you know, academics seldom question, who also lack any surviving contemporary mention, such as Jesus Christ. So that's an important wording that you put there, because I really like it. I think that these legends were based on an actual person, and you're the first person I've ever run into that actually shed light, and that this was perhaps this Owain Thakwyn was the bear, was this King Arthur. It's an incredible book. Where can people find this book and support your work?
Well, I have a web. Well, it's published by Inner Traditions, so it should be available in shops like Barnes and Noble. It's on Amazon.com, Amazon.co.uk, so you can buy it from Amazon. The publisher distributed it well. But if you want to sort of find about a little bit more and see some of the pictures of the places and things I've been describing before you decide to commit yourself to buying the book, my website is grahamphillips.net. And on the first page, you'll see the pictures of all my books, and you just click on one of those, and each one gives you a good few pages of information about what the book tells, the sort of things I've been talking to you about, plus there's plenty of diagrams and pictures.
There's so many books on here that I'm going to get going down that you've written. You've got them about Alexander the Great, about Robin Hood, about Moses, about Merlin. I can't wait to dig into these. I'm definitely fixing to be getting with you and getting some more of those.
Oh, great stuff. Thanks.
The history, the folks. This is one of those stories that I'm so glad someone took the time to do it, Graham. I'm really, really thankful that you took the time to really dig into this, because it's something that needs to be told. It's one of those things, like we said, it's too often, and you hit it perfect, that it's intertwined with the dragons and the fantasy realm, and everybody slowly, if it's not told now, it may completely fade out of existence to where it becomes nothing but folklore. But I think this story is really great as far as like a look back into history at how things can change, how a true story can be twisted over time and turned into folklore that we see now. And I think this book is ideal because we need to look at other stories like that. We need to look at other things in history, other folk tales, and look, and people need to dig into that and see if there is some truth to it, because we may be missing a whole lot more history of stuff that we thought was nonsense.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if this has been almost lost about Arthur, imagine how much stuff has been lost about a number of other historical figures.
That's right.
I mean, Arthur isn't the only person to go down in history under his battle name, by the way, or his title. I mean, we've all heard the famous Genghis Khan, who led the Mongols and founded the largest empire the world has ever known.
Temujin.
Genghis Khan was his title.
That's right.
Yeah. Universal ruler. His real name was Temujin.
Yes.
That's right, yeah.
So, I mean, it's not the first time that this concerns me. Okay, we know enough about Genghis Khan, but how many other figures are hiding out there under battle names and titles?
You're right. Makes you wonder, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us today, Graham. We really appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. What a fascinating person. Graham Phillips. Man, I really love this book. The book, once again, is The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, The Search for Camelot and the Isle of Avalon. I had no idea. I mean, we talked about it in the beginning and during the interview. I had no idea that this was even a possibility that King Arthur might have actually been a real person. And now through Graham's hard work, it seems that he was. And that these legends get made up, you know, the fancy fair, the stories. They get, you know, elaborated on through the telling and retelling by people. And I think that's what these stories were. But the fact that Excalibur's sword might have been real, that Merlin was a real man, it's incredible. And I love it so much. And I urge you, if you're interested in history and things like this, to pick up this book. Because there's a lot in the book that we didn't touch on, because we can't give away the whole book. Otherwise, there's no reason for somebody to buy the thing.
Or we'd have spent 2 hours here trying to go through it all.
There's a lot in there. And I think by the time you finish the book, there'll be little or no doubt in your mind that this is a real historical person.
Well, and it's like I discussed, I love the way he ties it together, because it's one of those things that I think we all should do it. We all need to look at history in those ways, and you kind of look at, kind of, there's nicknames, there's slang, there's all the stuff that goes on today. It went on back then as well.
Absolutely.
He's also, look, he's written several books. He started writing like in the early 80s. If you're interested in that book, folks, he's written a book on Robin Hood, like I said. He's written a book on Alexander the Great. He's written a book on Merlin and the discovery of Avalon in the New World. So I'm going to have to get a hold of him. We need to get him maybe to come back on, talk about what maybe he's found over here in North America. But he's written, I want to say there's like 13 books on his website, but I think he said 17 total is what he's written.
Yeah, he said he's written some books that he didn't even include on his website.
Some Shakespeare conspiracy books. Yeah, it's very interesting the way he digs in and all this stuff. And, well, he even told us off air, 30 years. 30 years he's been working on this story, the King Arthur story.
Right.
You know, not constant, but off and on for 30 years of his life, he's been looking into this and piecing it together and chasing this down to come to this book.
And I hope he starts like some kind of GoFundMe or Kickstarter program where he can actually fund the actual, you know, archaeological excavation.
Well, and to put pressure on the government. You know?
Yeah.
To find out. Now, look, to do it the right way, the whole thing. Yeah, let's find out if this is it. Let's exhume, let's make it, let's whatever, you know, whatever it takes. Let's get to the end of this. We'll know who this person was and if that's truly what it is. Because also, once it gets done, well, then think about what you can do. You'll be able to raise more money, I guess you could say, from the citizens to turn this into a more special area. To be like, right. Look, this is the last resting place of the man in folklore known as King Arthur.
Yeah, I agree. Everybody go out there, check out the show notes. I'll put links to the book. It's an excellent read. Well, we want to appreciate everybody. We appreciate everybody for being here and joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. If you have any stories or ideas of your own and you would like to send them to us, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. If you'd like to call the show, you can always call in 817-945-3828. And don't forget, I know I bring it up all the time, but if you're new to Expanded Perspectives, don't forget we do another episode every Thursday called Expanded Perspectives Elite. And you can sign up for that by going to the website, expandedperspectives.com. And if you really like the show, we would appreciate it if you wrote us a review on iTunes. Cam, what have you got planned for the rest of your week?
The weather is going to be beautiful.
Yeah, right. No, the rain has finally stopped.
Yep. I think I'm going to get outside and do a little work in the yard and mess around. And I might even go fish.
Well, I was taking a shower the other day, and I was like cleaning behind my ears, and I noticed that gills were starting to form, just like Kevin Costner on Waterworld.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Right, and my toes are becoming webbed like a Labrador.
Yeah. Right. So fun.
Yeah. Well, everybody, stay out of trouble and don't work too hard. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.